Welcome to the TJF podcast. My name is Ian Donnelly. There hasn't been a whole lot to laugh about in policing for a few years. This podcast is all about what it was like to be in the British police for the last 30 years. How did it change? And more importantly, how did it come to be in a bit of a mess? I'll describe every job that I did over those years, reading from my book, and I'll also give you my thoughts about contemporary policey stuff. I'll interview anyone brave enough to come on and ask them what they think. My wife Kay is going to help me from time to time. There may be a little bit of swearing, so probably better to keep the kids out of the room or use headphones. Everything I say and write comes out of a place of love for policing and police officers. But I know that some people probably won't agree with what I say, and that's completely okay. All I ask is that you read or listen with an open mind. And if you go away feeling that you know more about what policing in Britain is really all about, and perhaps also have a bit more empathy for police officers, then I've succeeded. So, here we go. Hello, everybody. Ian here. Thanks for coming back to the TJF podcast. Really pleased that you've decided to tune in and listen to another one. Flushed with success from the introduction. I've had lots of really lovely messages, emails, reviews as well, which is great, given that it's less than a week since the first introductory episode. Really pleased about that. Just on that one, if you like this, can you be an absolute star and go on the Apple Podcast app and rate and review it? There's a number of reasons for that. Firstly, the techie bit, the algorithms will push it further up the ranking charts by, you know, the more positive reviews you have, obviously. But I think the main reason, as far as I'm concerned, is that if you're listening to this and you think what I'm saying is important and interesting, the whole point that I'm doing this is to try and help people understand what it's really like to be in the police. And some of these messages need to be given to the people who seemingly routinely give the police a really hard time, undeservedly in my view, and undeservedly in the view of many serving police officers and past and present. Very often they get their information from the wrong places. They jump to conclusions and they make law and policy based on a very incomplete and flawed understanding of reality. So if we want to change things in policing, and I suggest we probably do, then the only way that that's going to happen is if we get this message out loud and clear. So, where are we going this week? I'm looking to drop a podcast in once a week. I think that's probably about the right frequency. And in future episodes, as I said before, I'm going to be going through the book and adding a bit of colour and flavour to the various chapters. So I'll deal with a chapter at a time. I'll do a little bit of a review of what's been going on in the news, adding my thoughts and observations to try and help those who don't really understand how the police works and sort of help you understand all of that a little bit better. I'm also going to try and wheel on relevant guests that will say something pertinent and hopefully interesting in relation to each of these chapters. And I've got some cracking people lined up who want to speak, some of whom I have worked with directly. My old boss actually has asked if he can come and speak at some point, and I'd love to have him on. His name's Clive Burgess, and he was my superintendent and my chief superintendent at various times, and he's also a friend. So really interesting guy, and I know he'll have a perspective that will be probably different to mine. And the people that I'm going to be speaking to, we're not going to agree on everything, I'm quite sure. And in fact, I don't want that. I would rather be challenged about this stuff. I don't want people just, preach. I don't want this to turn into like a echo chamber of nonsense, really. So So yeah, so I'm going to be wheeling on some really interesting people who've got a story to tell. Some of it will be about their challenges in the job, and others will just talk about how things used to be, and some of it will be, I'm sure, very amusing, no doubt. So I'm going to also introduce my wife at some point during this episode. She's a little bit shy, so just be nice to her when she comes on. Okay, so what exactly have people been saying who've been contacting me? Well, I think it broadly falls into two categories, the comments. The first sort of pot of comments tend to be from police officers, past and present, who have been saying, thank God someone's saying this as it is. So that's nice that they feel that I'm speaking for them, which is what I want to do, really. I think there's been so much frustration within the organisation for such a long time now, and they just don't feel that they're being listened to. No one's interested in what they're saying. So that's good. And the other point, which comes back quite a few times in a sort of a slightly sort of angry, challenging sort of way, which I'm really comfortable with, because I was, you know, quite senior myself when I left. You've got to remember that 80% of the police service nationally is police constables. That's the sort of lowest rank in the hierarchy. So they make up the vast majority of the organisation. And then you've got sort of, if you imagine going up a pyramid, then you've got a large number of sergeants who are probably another, I don't know, 10%. And then inspectors probably, I don't know, 5%. So people like me who was finished off as a superintendent is only a very tiny number of people in the organisation. And there is a perception, you know, amongst the rank and file, I suppose, that superintendents and above are a bit out of touch. I like to think that wasn't the case with me, but I know what they mean when they say that. So quite a few of them sort of said to me, I totally agree with everything you're saying, Ian, 100%, but why didn't you say this when you were currently serving? And that's a really, really good question. And I suppose the answer to that is that you're in a disciplined service. You're part of a large organisation, and you can't just come out and say whatever you like, no matter how strongly you feel about that. We're, you know, when you're a police officer, you're a public servant, and you have to be seen to be completely impartial and politically neutral. So to come out and do something like this while I was still serving would have been absolutely impossible. So that's the answer to that, really. And it wasn't really another sort of point I'd make was it probably wasn't for me personally to say these things. That should have been people at the very top of the organisation who should have been speaking for the entire organisation. So a review, given that I said that we would do a little bit of a review of the last week. So I suppose the thing that's really dominated the headlines for some of this week where the riots, well, I'm not quite sure you'd call it a riot, you'd certainly call it a very serious outbreak of disorder in Bristol on Sunday evening. So for those who aren't familiar with that incident, because you may be listening to this in another part of the world, or maybe you've been living in a cave in this country for the last week, we had a very serious outbreak of disorder in Bristol on Sunday evening, and it was a protest against the piece of legislation which is going through Parliament in the UK at the moment, and it's called the Police Crime Sentencing and Court Bill. And what that is a package of legislative change that the government wants to bring through, which will address a whole load of things, really. So I'm not going to go through all of it because a lot of it is you know, it's a very kind of mixed package of measures designed to, you know, change the criminal justice system and policing and hopefully make it a bit more representative of what, you know, the majority of people actually need and want. And one of those measures is to restrict the rights to protest and give the police additional powers to deal with protest. And when I say protest, I don't mean just all protest. That's not what it's about. This is about giving the police additional powers to deal with protest, which is causing significant disruption to the day-to-day lives of the majority of law-abiding people going about their lawful business. So if I just sort of talk a little bit about why I think this legislation has been proposed. So when I look back across the 30 years I was in the police, clearly there were incidents and outbreaks of disorder, rioting. You know, we had very serious riots across the whole of the UK in 2011, I believe it was, which came on the back of an incident in London when a chap was shot by the police and as part of an ongoing sort of police operation. It just spiraled into very, very serious rioting, which was just thuggery, really. It was nothing to do with the original precursor catalyst incident. It was just an opportunity for criminals and yobs to go out and smash everything up. But obviously protest is a well-established democratic right, and I would certainly do everything in my power, humanly possible, to protect the right to protest, both as a previous police officer as well as a private citizen now. But the reality is that in the last sort of, I wouldn't like to say how long, but certainly, the last 10 years or so, the democratic right to peaceful protest has been somewhat subverted by a small number of very, very vociferous activist groups who are small in number, but massive in impact. And the tactics that they have started to use increasingly, and we saw this in Bristol at the weekend, and we see it in Black Lives Matters last year, and we see it in the protests against, lawful business activities which have been sanctioned at a high level of government. So whether you agree with it or not, building roads or HS2, whatever you think about that, the fact is that it's perfectly lawful and it's been approved, in the courts. But these activist groups now organise and mobilise themselves very quickly using social media. They communicate using end-to-end encrypted technology, which is free on things like WhatsApp or Telegram or whatever, And the tactics they use are not about protesting peacefully. It's about causing as much disruption as possible to as many people as possible in as short a period of time. And the purpose of this bill is to say that is not acceptable. And if you do that, then the police will have additional powers to stop it. So obviously these groups don't like that. And I would have to say to any of them who may be listening, that you've caused this. You and your increasingly aggressive and disruptive and anti-democratic tactics, you have brought this upon yourselves. So if you're angry about it, then look to yourselves, look to the people who run your organisations and ask, could we have done things differently? Because it's a classic case of if you give somebody enough rope, eventually they hang themselves, don't they? And they've been given many opportunities to sort themselves out. But it's come to the point now where they don't engage with the police. They don't engage with local authorities. They don't do anything that will create the circumstances for a peaceful protest and quite the opposite. So anyway, that's the background to the bill. The disorder in Bristol on Sunday evening was termed a kill the bill protest. So one of the things, I've written a blog on this on my website, which you can go and have a look at. And what I thought was really reprehensible was, firstly, the fact that they actually called it kill the bill, because clearly was they were, rather disingenuously suggesting that it was about stopping the legislative bill. The wording was clearly designed to encourage supporters to kill police officers, kill the old bill. So anyone, any of them who think that, you know, that we're not stupid, you know, we clearly understand that that's what they were getting at. And if a police officer had been killed in Bristol on Sunday evening, then they would have had that firmly on their conscience, and they probably would have been arrested for incitement to murder, I would suggest, and quite rightly so. As it was, there was a lot of damage caused to property in the area. A police station was trashed. Lots of police officers were quite badly injured. A police van was set on fire. They were actually trying to set fire to one of the police vans while the police officers were inside it, which, in my view, is attempted murder. And I would hope that whoever was doing that will be charged with attempted murder in the fullness of time. So one of the great ironies for me in the way that these protesters behave is that they purport to be pushing back against authoritarianism and abuses by the state. Whereas in actual fact, what we see is a rabble of with people who are so kind of drunk on their ideology and a sense of moral superiority that they feel that they can bully and threaten both police officers and members of the public and businesses into bending to their will. And they don't see that actually this is the sort of extreme intolerance that resulted in people being herded up and locked away in Soviet gulags in the 1940s and 50s. Or for that matter, rounded up and herded into concentration camps and gas chambers in during the Second World War. It's exactly the same mentality where they so believe in their own ideology that they don't listen to anyone. They're not interested in what anyone else has to say. So what's it actually, I thought it'd be worth just talking a little bit about what's it actually like to be in the middle of one of these incidents as a police officer, because it's a type of policing unlike any other form of policing, I would suggest, and it's the one time in your career where you sort of move into a much different way of being, much different approach to what's in front of you. And I was a public order trained officer for many years, both as a PC and as a sergeant and as a inspector. The term is not riot training, it's public order training. So when you go to your public order training, which is generally, I don't know, something once a year or something like that, you go for your refresher training. And there's different levels. I'm a bit out of touch with all of that kind of stuff because basically I'm an investigator, detective, really. So it was never really the thing that I sort of, you know, was my specialism, so to speak. But so anybody listening to this, if I'm getting this wrong, please tell me. There's different levels. Levels 1, 2, and 3. I think level 2 is kind of the one that I did, which was trained to go into riot situations in full kit as this sort of second wave, really. Generally speaking, the first wave, certainly in London when I was doing it, would be the Territorial Support Group, the TSG. In West Midlands, they're referred to as the OSU, the Operations Support Unit. So they're the level ones. They're trained to a much higher level, and they'll generally be the first ones deployed into these situations. And then the level twos will come in behind them to support them. The level threes will be officers who are sort of trained up to a lower level, but generally won't be sort of fully kitted up, so to speak, with the flameproofs and overalls and all that. And I've got to put a picture on my website. I think it's under the chapter called Inner City Violence, of me wearing my flameproofs and all of that malarkey. So what's it actually like to be deployed into these situations? I think the first thing that's probably worth pointing out is that the majority of the people that you see at these events, the police officers in these events with their NATO helmets on and their flameproofs and whatnot, they are, in the main, they are the same police officers who will be patrolling your streets day and night, working in the community, responding to your lost children, dog shit on the footpath, or whatever it is that kind of you know, whatever reason you ring the police. Sorry, I'm being a bit glib there, I think. But you know what I mean. They're basically the same officers you'll see driving around, walking about. Although you don't see many of them walking around these days, you know, because we haven't got enough of them. But so don't think that we've got this kind of massive army of public order trained riot police just sitting around twiddling their thumbs, waiting to get called out, because that's not the case. They are officers who will be probably in the main have already done a day's duty before being deployed into that situation. They could be more likely they're going to be on rest days. They'll be called into work and told, get kitted up, you're going to Bristol or you're going to wherever. Okay. So I've been in those situations in a professional context a few times. Not that many, to be fair, because it's like a lot of things. You do a lot of training, but you don't tend to get deployed very often. You end up being stood, put on standby, kitted up, and there's many times when I was with a serial. So let's just get some of the language right for the non-police officers. Police PSU is the sort of standard operational unit of public order trained officers. Okay, so a PSU is comprised of, and if I get this wrong, anyone out there, can you please just fire me a message and say, Ian, we're talking out your arse and you got this wrong. So if I'm wrong, can you please just tell me? All right, so a PSU is one inspector, three sergeants and 18 constables who are deployed in three vans. Yeah, so in each van you have one sergeant and six fully kitted up public order trained officers to level two or level one, depending on where they're coming from. And you've got one inspector in charge of the whole PSU, okay? Being deployed into these situations can be quite exciting and scary at the same time. But it's all about the training. And if you've been well trained and you have a good serial on PSU, good people around you, then it can make the whole experience a whole lot better. And certainly the training is extremely realistic. I was trained, as I say, as a level two officer for many years. You would take part in simulated riots involving police horses, dogs, petrol bombs being thrown at you, dozens of petrol bombs. You'd be taught how to deal with petrol bombs, the fire extinguishers and various things. But they were genuine petrol bombs that you would literally have thrown at your feet, and you'd have to walk through them trying not to panic and flap. And there's all sorts of tactics for different scenarios, for taking junctions, for holding junctions, for going into buildings, for taking ground, as well as obviously the more offensive tactics about dealing with extremely violent people. So one of my kind of observations when I watched the news about Bristol at the weekend was how many of the public order officers I saw, and again, I could be really, really getting this wrong, so if I am, please forgive me. It could be that they were standing, maybe it was a funny camera angle, or they were maybe standing, on a drop curb or something like that. But an awful lot of the public order officers that I saw on television looked to be very small to me. I'm sorry to have to say that, but they did. They also looked very young, and that's probably because I'm just really old. But and the one thing that really struck me was a lot of them looked absolutely petrified. And so if you've got very young people, some of whom are very small and also very scared, that's not a brilliant combination in a riot situation. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's perfectly natural and normal to be scared. I think there'd be something wrong with you if you weren't. And it's all about controlling that fear and actually remembering your training and all of that kind of stuff. But there was something there for me about thinking, I'm not quite sure whether some of the people that we're putting into these situations now are quite cut out for it in terms of just their physical presence. And I know that sounds like, I sound like such a dinosaur saying that. I really do. I know I do. And I'm probably going to get people saying, you can't say that. Well, I'm sorry, I've just said it. Some of those people looked very small to me. And, you know, I can't think when the year that they abandoned the height restriction in policing. And I know there's all sorts of reasons for that. It was all part of the, again, I could be wrong here, but I think that was a human rights thing. You know, you can't help being small, can you? But there was a time, certainly when I joined, that male officers, I believe, had to be over 5'9", was it? I think it was. And female officers had to be over a certain size. And there was also in the riot training, I'm calling it riot training, aren't I? Flipping idiot. The public order training, there were certain aspects of it that were physically extremely demanding. And I know for a fact that they abandoned some of those a few years ago because I think, frankly, people weren't able to do it anymore. I think that was part of the reason. It was seen as being unfair to certain individuals, which to my mind is nonsensical. So one of the things that they abandoned in the training was the shield run, what was called the shield run. So on the first day, you would have to do the shield run. And that was really hard. And if you didn't make it in the allocated time, you'd be failed off the course and that you wouldn't be allowed to be a public order officer. So what that involved was running a route all around the training base, which is about, I have no idea, 400, 500, 600 metres, something like that, maybe 500, 600 metres. And it was against the clock. I can't remember what time you had to do it in, but you had to do it pretty quickly. And you had to run holding the full shield, which are bloody heavy things, and they're really awkward. And if it's a windy day, the wind would catch the bloody thing and blow you all over the place. I was a bit of a racing snake in those days. I was very fit. And I used to really love the shield run. I thought it was great. And I used to absolutely blitz it. And I used to do it quite quickly. But it is hard. It's physically hard. So they did away with the shield run, I believe. And because obviously some officers, when they abandoned the height restrictions, I think some of the officers probably struggled with that. So if I'm wrong here, please tell me, okay? So there might be... senior public order officers out there listening to this thinking, Ian, you're talking nonsense. We still do the shield run, but I don't think you do. And I saw some stuff on our website the other day, our police Facebook site, bemoaning the fact that they don't do the shield run anymore because they can see that it weeded out people who just weren't physically up to doing that job. So the analogy for me would be, you know, would the army say to someone, don't worry, you don't have to jump over that wall. And if that rucksack gets a bit too heavy, you can just put it down. Don't worry about it. Someone else will carry it for you. Or you know what? Don't. You know, the army wouldn't do that, would they? There's a standard there which you either pass or fail. And it doesn't matter whether you're male or female. There's a standard there that if you can pass it and get through, then you're kind of home and dry. And certainly some of the toughest officers I ever encountered in public order were women. And there was one particular officer, and I really hope that she doesn't mind me giving her a shout out. In fact, I'm not going to give her surname because I think that would be wrong to identify her in this one. But her first name was Tracy. Anybody from the Met back in the 1980s and 90s will know exactly who I'm talking about. And she was formidable. She was a public order training instructor. And she, I'm going to swear now. She kicked the living shit out of everyone. She was absolutely unbelievably strong. And I remember one of the exercises that we used to have to do was to go into a room as a shield serial and take out someone who was armed and extremely violent. And these are very common situations that you deal with in policing. It happens all the time. I did it as a uniform sergeant, a uniform inspector. And anyone who's been level two trained frequently gets called on a typical day to go into an address and take out someone who's got a weapon or who is extremely agitated and is a danger to themselves or to other people. So we get trained how to do that. And I remember going into the, we used to call it, sorry, this is not very politically correct, is it? We used to call it the Nutter scenario, and used to go into the Nutter room. And one day, Tracy was the Nutter. So she was all sort of padded up with elbow guards and leather gloves and helmet and knee pads and all of that stuff. And she absolutely beat the crap out of three of us. So this isn't a gender argument I'm making. It's just a practical common sense observation that I think some people are cut out for public order training and some people are not. And the people who are not cut out for it, either because of their size or they're maybe a bit overweight or whatever, then they probably need to be told, I'm really sorry, but obviously you can't grow anymore, obviously. But, you know, if someone is very overweight, then they're not going to be able to keep up with the rest of the, you know, the officers in a very violent situation. Anyway, I've probably flogged that to death a little bit, but I just wanted to sort of explain how it all worked. So when you're actually in these situations, it can be quite terrifying sometimes. I think the worst one I dealt with was actually when I was on duty it was a Remembrance Day Sunday in London, and we'd all been bussed into London to police the Remembrance Day in the Cenotaph and Whitehall and around sort of Horse Guards and Westminster. And obviously that attracts many, many, many thousands of people. And the police are there. And it's a very, very lovely deployment, actually, because you get to speak to some lovely people, the military veterans and their families. And so we went up to Whitehall, and it was number one dress uniform because it was Remembrance Sunday. So that meant in those days it was long sort of raincoats. This is in the days when police officers looked pretty smart, with nice shiny silver buttons and whistle chains and smartly ironed trousers, although that was not necessarily the case. Some of them were right scruffy buggers, but generally speaking, we were pretty smart in those days, I think. Because it was Remembrance Sunday, it was number one dress uniform, so it was white gloves. And it was really nice, chatting to the families and the nice people, you know, which is always an absolute joy, because most of your day is taken up with dealing with people who aren't like that at all, you know. We got redeployed. We heard it was all kicking off in the East End of London. There was a big National Front march, because obviously these idiots, they hijack the Union Jack, don't they? They think they're more patriotic than anybody else, and they're just a bunch of knuckle draggers, aren't they, really? So the National Front were kicking off in the East End. They were being opposed by the left-wing sort of anti-right-wing lot, who, to be quite honest, are just as bad as them. They're all as bad as each other, frankly. If somebody said to me, would you rather deal with extreme right-wing or extreme left-wing, I'd say, personally, I'd rather not deal with any of them because they're all a bunch of idiots. But we got bussed over to the East End of London. We didn't have any public order kit. We were put into this situation, and it was all going off at Haydock. And we were getting bottled and bricked, having street furniture thrown at us. And generally, it was bloody terrifying because we had no way of protecting ourselves. Our supervisors were screaming for backup. We were getting attacked from both sides at this point. So we were properly caught. And we were basically trying to keep this lot apart. And we were getting absolutely, I think the word is mullered. Eventually, a load of shield serials got deployed against them, and we were withdrawn from it. But it was an absolute bloody nightmare because we didn't have any protective equipment, and there was quite a few people injured that day. It was not very nice at all. So, just going back to the whole Bristol thing, clearly there's a massive investigation taking place by Avon and Somerset Police, and I wish them all the best with that, and hope it goes well, and they can identify and lock up as many of these idiots as they can. And again, just to help you understand what happens when these things are over, there is a massive investigation into these things where they examine countless hours of CCTV footage, camera phone footage, footage from the media, and then they'll do a whole load of arrests to hopefully as quickly as possible to get these people into custody. So yeah, they're looking for them at the moment. So anyway, I'm going to move on to the book now. So last podcast, I gave you just a bit of a basic introduction. This time I'm going to sort of look at chapter one, which is called How Does the UK Police Service Work? So in this chapter, it's kind of split into two bits, really. The first bit is all about police ranks, structures, how the whole organisation kind of hangs together nationally. And I'm not going to go into that in this because you can read it yourself. It's a bit dry for those who are currently police officers. I think I'm just going to be telling them stuff they already know. If you're not a police officer, just have a read of it. It's probably really, really useful for you to understand how it all works. I suppose the only point I would make now is that in terms of structures, if I was to give someone the job of, I said to them, right, I want you to go away and devise the most inefficient structure for British policing that you can possibly come up with. And then if they came back with what it currently looks like, I'd have said, you've overperformed, you've exceeded the brief that I've given you, because the structures nationally at the moment are just really inefficient. You've got 43 individual forces in England and Wales who all do things differently. And you've got police service in Northern Ireland, and you've got Police Scotland. And so you've got 45 just in sort of the UK, and then you've got a load of other sort of odds and sods of policing in terms of other organisations here and there, like BTP and British Transport Police, that is, and our Civil Nuclear Police or the MOD Police and various things. But basically you've got, let's just talk about England and Wales because that's where I live and that's where I've worked. So you've got 43 different forces, so you've got 43 different command teams, 43 different sort of IT teams and HR functions and different IT systems and goodness knows what else. And it really is a very messy, horrible setup. And certainly in my role as a independent technology advisor, that's kind of one of the first things I have to try and explain to technology suppliers, that it's not a one size fits all, that every force is different. And some will look at, you know, you could put 10 people from 10 different forces into the same room and show them exactly the same thing, and some of them will think it's absolutely amazing and others will think it's absolutely rubbish and others just won't even know what they're looking at. So trying to do business with the police service from a tech point of view is really, really challenging sometimes. So the bit I am going to talk about, and this is kind of, you just got to indulge me here a little bit, because it's one of the things that has really got on my nerves for a long time, is telepolice. The telepolice versus real police, okay? So many people, I think, and it drives me crackers, as it does to kind of pretty much everybody else I've ever worked with. You know, when you go to a dinner party or you go to the pub and you meet someone who you don't know, and they find out you're a police officer and they ask you all the same questions, and so many of the questions and so many of their opinions seem to be formed on the basis of what they've read or seen on television. They don't read anything on television. That's stupid, isn't it? Come on in. It's seen on television. And so, yes, there's certain things that you see again and again on television about the police, which is just nonsense. So I'm gonna talk through a few of those, the ones that kind of annoy me the most. And it's poor Mrs. Donnelly. I do feel sorry for her, bless her. I'm going to wheel her on and she'll introduce herself in a bit. But it makes watching these things in our house very stressful for her, bless her, because I end up getting a bit agitated. At the very least, I roll my eyes a lot. At worst, I end up shouting at the television. So anyway, here we go. So one of the first ones is, you see this a lot on police dramas, uniform officers standing at attention, usually either inside or outside an interview room where a suspect has been interviewed. Okay, where do they get that from? I've no idea. I've never seen a uniformed police officer stood at attention like a spare prick at a wedding, either inside or outside an interview room. It's like, why would you do that? So another point of that is that if nobody had noticed, we don't even have enough police officers now to go and investigate your burglary, never mind to stand around outside an interview room for no reason. Okay. Another one, police officers wearing their hats inside police stations. Why would you do that? Police officers don't wear their hats inside the police station, okay? In fact, to my slight irritation, I don't see that many police officers wearing their hats outside the police station, never mind inside the police station, which is annoying and says a lot about sort of standards dropping, in my view. I'm sounding like a right old fart, but there you go. So there's no blue lights left flashing on a stationary police car. And that's even more annoying when it's parked on like a pea gravel drive of a wisteria clad house in the Cotswolds, dealing with another middle class pretend murder. Okay, so I've no idea where they get this idea from, that you park a police car up, walk away from it, and leave the lights flashing. So basically, if you do that, the battery runs flat really quickly. And your colleagues will take the piss out of you, and quite rightly. The only reason for having blue lights flashing in the car is to get through traffic, all right? So please, TV directors, can you just switch the blue lights off when they get to where they're going? Because it just looks stupid. Unless, of course, you just do it just to annoy me, which is fine, because, you know, that's fine. There's lots of other things that you do to annoy me, so you might as well just add that one to the list. Right, senior officers in TV dramas pompously addressing junior officers as constable. It doesn't happen. Senior officers generally refer to them as, by their first names. The only exception to that is, government ministers leaving Downing Street. They rather pompously refer to them as constable. Barristers in court, for some reason. I did this just to wind my brother in the book, because my brother is actually a criminal barrister. He was a police officer. Joined the Metro Police like me and left and became a barrister. But I think that generally speaking, the barristers as a collective, they're sort of psychologically and procedurally stuck somewhere between sort of 1850 and 1911. But so they call you constable, which is quite annoying, and also. People like we had out in Bristol the other night, and but they usually put the emphasis on the first syllable of the word, if you get what I mean. Right, another thing that gets on my nerves is senior officers interviewing suspects in custody. Okay, so very often in these dramas, you'll get someone like as a superintendent or chief superintendent interviewing the suspect. It doesn't happen. 90% of, probably more, probably 99% of interviews of suspects in custody are done by a detective constable or a detective sergeant. In other words, someone who knows what they're doing. Let me see, what are the other ones that are quite annoying? Oh yeah, suspects in interviews crumbling and telling the police officers everything they've done. I don't think I've ever seen it in my entire career. I'd say 95% of interviews in police custody generate no comment to every single question put to them, which can be very frustrating, and that's their legal right to do that. And they will do that on their solicitor's advice. The solicitor will speak to them in the interview room before the start of the interview, and they will basically tell them to answer no comment to every question. And sometimes sometimes, you know, they'll leave an answer, no comment. When you say to them, can you just state, for the purposes of the tip, can you please state your name? And they'll go, no, no comment. And the solicitor will say, no, 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 you can't answer that question. Cheers, thanks for that. So there we go. Here we go, another one. Surveillance officers sticking out like sore thumbs and making it really obvious to everyone in a 200-yard radius that they're a surveillance officer. So you see them sitting in cars with the ridiculous kind of dangly earpieces or talking into handheld radios or using binoculars or using a camera with a big long lens, and they're about like 30 yards away from the suspect. In reality, and having been on a surveillance team myself, in reality, it would be extremely difficult to spot a good surveillance team. So, they don't do that. Yeah, and sort of linked to that one is characters in police dramas following a suspect in a car on their own, driving about 30 yards behind them, and following them for miles and miles, and gaining eventually the crucial piece of evidence that they need. So from a surveillance point of view, it's almost impossible to follow someone driving a car unless you've got a full surveillance team. Because basically you get stuck at the first set of traffic lights. So that doesn't happen. Yeah, another one, corrupt officers everywhere you look. So this is probably pointed, sort of directed at line of duty, really, because, oh dear, where do you start with line of duty? It's just rubbish. I know you probably really like it out there and you think it's great, but it's just rubbish. And so I'm sorry to have to disillusion you, but corrupt officers absolutely everywhere. Pretty much everyone's corrupt in line of duty. And again, in reality, that's just not the case. I know it's only telly. I know, but it's not the case. And the reason I think it's important to make this point is that I don't want people to think that there's corrupt officers everywhere in the police. There just really, really aren't. Anti-corruption units weed them out very quickly. Clearly, we do get officers who go bent. There's plenty of evidence of that. But they are a tiny, 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 tiny minority. And they generally get caught fairly quickly. So let me see. Another one that's slightly annoying. People like pathologists, coroners, and prosecuting lawyers getting involved in the criminal investigation. So you think about things like BBC Silent Witness or Judge John Deed, for example. They don't, okay? They've got their job to do. They've got quite enough to do, probably cutting up dead bodies and finding out what killed them or, preparing their case for court or whatever. They don't get involved in the police investigation in any way. Okay. Yeah, another one that I always find amusing/annoying is crime scene investigators examining and photographing a crime scene, wearing their white forensic suits, paper boots and face masks. And then the senior detective tromps into the crime scene wearing a suit and tie with probably dog shit all over his shoes, wiping dog shit on the carpet and picking stuff up. Okay, doesn't happen. So crime scene managers, extremely highly trained, extremely good at what they do. No one is allowed into that crime scene without their permission. And generally speaking, there's no reason for anyone else to go into the crime scene. What will happen is certainly when I was an SIO, and it's exactly the same now. As soon as the crime scene has been discovered, say for example, you've got a murder and you've got blood all over the place, and you've got a police officer who's gone in there, identified what's gone on, they will retreat, lock it all down. They'll have their shoes and their clothes probably seized and bagged up for evidence. No one will go in there at all until the crime scene examiner gets there, and there will be a route identified into the crime scene through a cordon, which will be a sterile cordon, depending on how big the crime scene is. And you don't get the sweaty detective with egg yolk down his tie and having a fag or whatever walking in there and starting to pick stuff up. It just doesn't happen. Okay. And lastly, and this is one of my favourites, I've got to say, is cops shouting, "Oi, you!" when they're about 50 yards away from the person that they're looking for, which obviously does a number of things. It alerts the person, who then, funnily enough, starts running away, so it gives them a head start. And then it results in a completely unnecessary foot chase by car, or jumping over hedges and fences between railway carriages and God knows what else, okay? So, again, if you're out and about, either in uniform or plain clothes, and you see someone who you want to speak to, because you know they might be wanted for an offence, or they, you know, they're wanted on, say, a recall to prison or something like that, what you do is you very, very quietly and unobtrusively get as close to them as you possibly can. And if you can, you take them firmly by the arm and you arrest them to stop them running away. You don't shout at them and give them a head start. Okay, so as I promised, I'm going to introduce you to my wife, Kay, the smog monkey. So, darling, would you like to just introduce yourself briefly?
I'd probably not introduce myself as a smog monkey, if you don't mind. I can't believe you said that.
Okay, so just a little bit about you and your background.
Yeah, so obviously got Ian's background, but I'm what, personal or...?
Whatever you want.
Whatever I want. Well, I'm currently not working, which is brilliant. I've just taken voluntary redundancy from IBM, where I've been for 26 years. Had a great career there, but decided that it was about time I did something. It takes me a while to get into change things, but fancy doing something a little bit different. So, currently at home, sorting out the loft, still in lockdown, kids back at school.
She was getting really grumpy yesterday because she'd been up in the loft for how many days? Was it 4 days?
Yeah.
And day one was like, oh God, this is going to be amazing. I'll get rid of all this crap. Day two was like, oh God, this loft's really, I'm really bored. Day four, I think you were just about to throw yourself out of the loft, weren't you?
I've got nowhere to put the stuff either, which I want to get rid of, which is...
So anyway, smog monkey. So just explain... Just explain what a smog monkey is, darling.
So I was called a smog monkey, and it was actually a term of affection from... a guy, Paul, Geordie Paul, who I used to share a house with. People know from the North East, and the North East is a big area, but people from Teesside are sometimes called smoggies. I think it's from the football club. I think people visiting Middlesbrough, the borough, they call the football supporters smoggies because of all the industry and the chimneys, ICI and the like. I'm not actually from Middlesbrough, but anyway. Monkey is a reference to monkey hanger, which people call anybody who lives in Hartlepool monkey hangers, which goes back to a folklore back in Napoleonic times, where there was a shipwreck off Hartlepool, and the people of Hartlepool had never seen a Frenchman before or a monkey.
So they thought they'd been invaded, didn't they?
They thought they'd been invaded, and they put this monkey on trial, which got washed up on the beach, apparently in military uniform, the tale goes, and they held a trial, and because it couldn't speak, and they thought it was a French spy, so they hung it on the beach.
So they're called monkey hangers, aren't
they? Monkey hangers, so a combination of both. I'm not from Hartlepool either, but there we go. I'm called Smog Monkey.
Brilliant. Okay, so there you go.
Thanks.
It's all right. My pleasure. And so just briefly, just for a couple of minutes before we finish the podcast, I think it's probably not a bad moment just to sort of ask you about being married to a police officer. So, I mean, obviously, I mean, it goes without saying here that obviously you are blessed beyond words to be married to me.
Obviously. Every day I think how lucky I am.
So yeah, that's, I mean, I like to remind, say to Kay that, you know, when she pulled the handle of the slot machine of life, all those three triple bars came up all in a row.
Yeah, ka-ching, 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 not.
So what's it like, I'll shut up, what's it like being married to a police officer?
So you have you did actually leave the police? Do you remind me?
I know.
You that?
Oh yeah. Well, okay. Not police officer. Okay, I'm not a police officer anymore. But But I think that's
that's an interesting point actually, because I think although obviously you've handed in your warrant card and your badge, you know, I think once you've done 30 years or amount of time in any service, you know, it's hard just to walk away from that. I think you've probably got that kind of police officer. There's so many things that you do today, which, you know, it's you've been trained in a certain way.
Like my driving, which you like very much.
Like, I was just going to mention your driving because you still drive, and it's the one thing which gets on my wick is you still drive like you're on surveillance. No lane etiquette, no signalling, even when you're taking the kids to school. In my car, which I'm not happy about because people think I'm a bit of a rat driving. But, no, I mean, I think when... you know, when you're in the police and all the different roles that you did. I mean, I think for me, one thing that we needed to be was organised. And I'm using the we term because you're not and I am mostly. But sometimes some of the jobs that you did, just thinking when you're in the CT in the counterterrorism unit, you know, you would be going out to work on possibly a shift, just depending on what was kind of cracking off. And I wasn't never sure when you'd be coming back because obviously criminals don't work 9 till 5.
Well, I told you I was going to work, didn't I?
Apparently.
Actually, it was my fancy woman, wasn't it?
Good luck to her. But I think, and because of that, the implications for us, and at the time we had I was pregnant and we had a baby. Is you have to be super organised. Things like, you know, getting the dog walk, you know, getting the dog to doggy daycare, getting the kids to nursery and then me into work or your older kids back to school.
There's one time, wasn't there, when I was in the counterterrorism unit where it was a very, very busy period, wasn't it? And I was probably at work sort of 16 hours a day, probably for weeks and weeks at a time sometimes. You know, and occasionally you'd even sleep on the floor, you know. Yeah, anyway, sorry, I'll shut up. This is about you, not me, isn't it? Go on.
No, but that thing is important because, you know, you're not sure quite when, or if you make plans, they may not always, you know, you may not always be available to come there. And that's just the nature of the job and what is married to a copper, you kind of just accept there's a world out there which, you know, you're keeping us safe at the end of the day. And you've got to do your job, so...
You used to get a bit freaked out by some of the conversations I'd have, wouldn't you?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I think that's another thing is that I think what your normal is and the way you talk to... I mean, just thinking of some of the most horrific things which you've had to deal with and your, you know, your mates and stuff as well, is sometimes you need a certain type of humour just to get through that. You know, dealing with babies, dead babies and children and, just some really depressing and sad stuff. But I think it gives you a certain kind of, it changes your character. And I think, you know, you've got to get through that. If every police officer is a human being, you know, you're not born a police officer, are you? You've got to deal with some of that stuff. And I think sometimes some things that you find funny, not everybody else would.
No idea what you're talking about. No, there is a bit of a dark sense of humour there, isn't there? But I mean, I used to have to be quite careful, didn't I, if I was on the phone when I was a DI in the child protection unit. So,
yeah, and that's
so
when I first met you. I remember we were taken into a Chinese on a... I don't know if it was after you first joined, after we first got together, but you would take a call. We're just about to, you know, have a glass of wine and a Chinese, and your phone would ring, and then you'd just start this line of questioning, which it was like, I don't think I need to have this stuff in my head about what the circumstances of a child death. And, you know, you were obviously just very methodically going through elimination. So, and then literally you'd say, sorry, love, I've got to go. And you'd go off into the night to the other side of Birmingham and, you know, obviously deal with, you know, a horrendous situation, a grieving family, and then literally come back in the early hours and basically climb back into bed and, you know, as if
make love to you.
In your dreams. You're outrageous.
No, I didn't do that because I was probably a bit tired, tired and emotional. Right, okay, well, listen, thank you, darling, that was very helpful. And so what I'm going to be doing as it goes on is I'm going to be wheeling Kay on from time to time. She hasn't actually got wheels, by the way.
Lancasters.
She's got legs. So I'm going to bring her on from time to time, just talk about various things, just to get a different perspective, because, you know, we don't necessarily agree on everything. And, you know, I think I hinted in the last first episode that, you know, there's aspects to this podcast and this website that we're not in complete agreement on, you know, particularly specifically around the risks that that poses, you know, to me. In some respects, you know, in terms of getting some adverse publicity and, you know, in some of the reviews, you think about, you know, some of the nasty people I've dealt with over the years and all of that kind of stuff. And so there you go. Anyway, thanks very much for that, darling.
My pleasure.
So there you go. My lovely wife, the smog monkey, you've met her now, and get her back at some point and we'll have a chat. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. Thanks ever so much. Don't forget, rate and review on Apple Podcasts. That'll be really great. See you next week. Bye.